This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with another edition of the Eye on Travel podcast. It looks like the world of travel in 2020 will end the way it began, with a fair share of disruption. But there are some glimmers of hope. I'll check in with Gene Sloan, who covers the cruise industry for The Points Guy. Gene was a passenger on the first ship to sail in the Caribbean, and he'll let us know what happened when a passenger and then six others tested positive for COVID-19. Then, Chris Woodyard from USA Today with a report on COVID-19 around the world and travel restrictions, and politicizing mask wearing, why there needs to be a federal rule requiring passengers to wear masks on planes. And then, I'll chat with Scott McCartney, travel editor of the Wall Street Journal, about what a new president might mean for the travel industry, as well as your travel plans. First up, the post-cruise report from Gene Sloan. My next guest, one of our regulars on the show, didn't expect him to be on the show this week for reasons that he will gladly explain. About 10 days ago, he sent me an email saying he was about to be on one of the very first cruises, if not the first cruise, sailing in the Caribbean from Barbados to a number of island countries in the Caribbean. And he did, on the Sea Dream 1. I'm going to let him tell the rest of the story, because let's just say that Gene Sloan is now talking to us from his self-quarantining back in the United States. Hey, Gene.
Hey there. Yes, that's it. I am locked down in a bedroom with my wife delivering food outside my door. So it's good to actually talk to somebody at least.
I'm so glad I could help you. but you were there to report on the first cruise with what seemed to be some rigorous testing procedures and some protocols and behavioral regimes on board the Sea Dream One. There were only 53 passengers and 66 crew. You were one of the passengers.
Yeah, that's it. I went down there, of course, not expecting the story that it turned out to be, but to write about what this first cruise was going to be like. This was a big deal cruise for the industry because it was the very first one in the Caribbean all the way back to March was the last departure. And it's a small line, Sea Dream, very small ship, but they were trying to get back up and started. So I went down there like other passengers. I got on board. First few days went great. It was actually much more normal feeling than I had expected with all the sort of precautions and, you know, the social distancing, all the things the cruise lines are implementing. And then 4 days into the trip, I was just heading back to my cabin, and the captain came over a loudspeaker and said somebody had started to feel sick and had called the doctor, been quickly tested, and tested positive.
And at that point, you remained in your cabin.
Yeah, so, and that was it. And they, you know, like all lines, they luckily had come up with a plan for this kind of thing. Of course, they didn't expect it to happen, but they immediately told us to go back to our cabins and said we were going to isolate, and that was it. That was Wednesday, and then I never saw the outside of my door for the next 4 days, as did the whole ship locked down. All the passengers on board were quarantined into their cabins, and non-essential crew also. Very limited crew stayed out and active. They tested all the crew, came back negative, and then, you know, we kind of went into a very different kind of cruise. I mean, it was, you know, delivering food to our doors, trying in a very kind of orchestrated, non-contact way. At that point, we had sailed down to St. Vincent and the Grenadines. We were anchored off one of the islands down there when this announcement happened. It immediately turned the ship full speed back to Barbados. And we got in late that night. It was about a 10-hour sail. It was bumpy because they were going so fast. And the health authorities came out immediately and started doing their thing.
Well, I'm amazed they even let you land based on the fear factor. We saw what happened with Holland America earlier this year, being unable to land at any port for a while. But this cruise by the way, we're talking to Gene Sloan, who does all the cruise reporting for the Points Guy. Gene, this ship was supposedly sailing from Barbados to a number of islands in the Caribbean, then coming back to its supposedly home port in Barbados. So how many ports did you actually get to?
So we ended up at four different islands. And what's interesting here is what they were trying to do with this sailing is create a bubble on the ship. So they were testing extensively before we got on. And the idea was that we were a COVID-free bubble. So when we went to these islands, they purposely did activities. We landed places where there were no people. The idea was we didn't want to interact with the people on the land because we were the ones without COVID and they were the ones who might have it. It turned out to be the opposite. But we landed mostly in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. We would do like little, you know, shuttle on a Zodiac to an empty beach where there were no people. They had prearranged with St. Vincent that we could have access to beaches that were uninhabited, in some cases on uninhabited little islands off of the main islands. Eventually, we were supposed to get to Grenada, but that of course, didn't happen because that was towards the end of the cruise.
Exactly. So here's my question. The way they were doing the testing was you were tested before you ever got to the ship, and then you were tested before you boarded the ship. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's it. And that's why they were so confident. You know, the whole cruise industry is trying to figure out a way to get back. And what most lines are talking about is one test before you go to the ship. What these guys did was 3 days before I flew down there, I had to go to a clinic here and get, you know, the gold standard PCR test they send out to the lab. Tested negative for that. Had to show them that when I got there. And then the day of departure, as I arrived at the pier, they had set up a medical tent, and they did another round with testing. They used those Abbott ID Now machines, which can get a test back pretty quick. It's the same machines they use at the White House. Of course, they maybe had some issues there, too. But two negatives. Every person who got on board that ship had gotten two negatives over a three-day period.
So you would think they were doing their homework.
Yeah, and they thought somehow, and this is, you know, this of course points up, I think the lesson of this is no matter how extensive you do the testing in advance, or try to keep the COVID off ships, it's going to get through at times. Maybe much, you know, maybe they'll catch most of it, but, you know, somehow one person, maybe they had been exposed just, you know, the day before, they had such a low viral load, it didn't give a positive, but somehow somebody got on board who had some of the virus in their system, and over a few days it got to the point where they showed symptoms.
Now, by the time you got back to Barbados, you'd been on the ship for 4 or 5 days. Did any other people test positive?
Yes. Yeah, so it was interesting. They did have us. From the, and other lines will do this too. There was a social distancing rule for the moment we got on board. So different groups of people were told to stay separate, and mostly did. What happened was, first there was one person positive. They started testing everybody on board with the machines the ship had. Then Barbados came on board and started doing its own tests, and the kind that go out to the lab, the PCR test. And they did start getting more positive. Most of them were in the same family group with the one guy who tested positive the first time. People staying in their same cabins together. So it was a group of sisters and their husbands. But there also was one other couple that tested positive. So as of today, it's been now many days, so it's probably where we're going to be, but there were 7 passengers out of 53 who were positive.
So that's more than 10%.
More than 10%, yeah. I see it as, it's good and bad. I mean, I think as of now, at least it appears it did not spread beyond these two groups. So it's a family of 5 and another couple who, what I've heard from other passengers, I don't know the couple. I didn't interact with the couple. That couple interacted with the family of 5. So clearly it spread on board, but it did not spread wildly on board, and they were able
to the seven passengers that did test positive, are they still in Barbados?
Yes. So they were all sent to an isolation facility. Barbados has done an incredible job with COVID. There's basically no cases of COVID in Barbados. They're very strict, even to get into Barbados. I would have had to have a COVID test within 3 days of flying, even if I wasn't going on the ship. Because wow. That's a Barbados rule, too. And so they have very little there, and they've set up a quarantine facility. So they do have people flying in who then test positive, and they quarantine them there. Or in this case, people coming off the ship. And they're going to be there for a while.
I guess the question becomes this. In the short term, what happens to that particular ship? Are they sailing again, or they've canceled all the cruises?
Yeah. So we just found out today that they've canceled all their sailings for the rest of the year. They initially, in the first few days, just canceled this week's cruise. But yeah, it looks like, and we'll see what happens in January. So they've canceled everything through January 1st. And originally had planned to run these Barbados cruises all the way through, I think, April. But given what happened, I think it may be tough for them to come back too quickly.
So here's the bigger question here. We know that the Centers for Disease Control lifted the ban, the no-sail ban, on October 31st. We all know that doesn't mean that the ships are sailing as of November 1. They didn't, and they won't. There's a very strict protocol and requirement in place for the ships to do a lot of testing to basically support, in some cases, a 74-separate-point renovation and redesign plan, whether it's their ventilation systems or social distancing or even floor plans, boarding procedures, shore excursions, you name it, at every touch point of any kind of trip. So for all intents and purposes, most cruise lines will not be sailing until late January, early February anyway, right?
Yeah, you know, and I actually think, and maybe I'm an outlier here, but I'm thinking we're really not going to see cruising out of U.S. ports and I would say most North America until at least March or maybe even April. the CDC has made this roadmap for them to come back, but there's so many hoops in it. You know, there's going to have to be test cruises, and there's going to have to be forced testing with a testing system put in place, and kind of nailing everything down. There's like a 60-day waiting period while they until they can actually to get the certificate to start. I think it's going to be a long time. Of course, what happened this week doesn't help.
Right, and part of that 60-day period, if I read the rules carefully, is that they're going to do a test cruise with crew only to see if all the systems work. So the crew being essentially the guinea pigs on that. But then certain cruise lines like Royal Caribbean are asking for volunteer cruisers, folks like you and me, if they want to volunteer to be testers sometime in January, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. I wonder how much of that is PR versus what will really happen. Of course, the CDC has a say. The CDC is setting the rules for this, and it's unclear who is going to be allowed on these test cruises. I suspect what it'll mostly be is employees of the company, friends and family, maybe some travel agents. Hopefully me. I would love to get on board see what all the new protocols are like. But, we'll see if, you know, just regular people are really let on board. Although Royal Caribbean put out a call and they got, I think I read 100,000 is what they're up to now. Just regular people volunteering, say, hey, take me.
Well, you know what? At a certain point, listen, there are a lot of loyal cruisers out there, people who are repeat cruisers who can't wait to get back out. It's the new cruisers that have the problem with perception of thinking that these cruise ships are nothing more than floating Petri dishes. That's the challenge for the cruise industry to turn them around.
Yeah, that's going to be the real issue here. And I think, the repeaters are just itching to go. And in fact, it was interesting on the seating trip. We were told to social distance, and I did, and we did. But I would talk to people from a distance. I'd say, hey, why are you on board? You know, this COVID thing's going on right now. Like, why would you book this? These people were the hardcore cruisers. And what was interesting is they weren't necessarily even Sea Dream cruisers. You know, I talked to somebody who was a Seabourn fan and another person who did Norwegian Cruise Line. And they said, I'll just take anything I can get to get back on a ship right now. And there's a lot of cruisers that are that way. But, you know, of course, the cruise business can't stay in business just getting their repeats. They need to constantly be bringing in new people. And I think, it's going to be a hard sell for a long time.
So how are they going to do it? How do you think they're going to do it?
Well, a couple things are going to happen here. One thing is that initially they won't have a huge amount of capacity to fill. So it's more of a long-term issue. So when they do come back, and like I said, I'm probably on the far end of when I think they'll come back, but say they start getting some ships in the water by March or April, the big lines, Royal Caribbean, Carnival, we're talking, they're only going to initially come back with two or three ships. Like Carnival has 23 ships. Maybe they bring two back or three back. They've all said this. They want to do it slow, and they don't want to have to drop their prices insanely either. So they're going to bring back enough that they can fill, enough that they can feel confident that, hey, this is going to work. And then slowly add. Also, because there's a huge cost to them to bring the crew back and to get a ship fired up to run. It takes weeks and it costs a lot of money to launch. So they want to do it little by little because they want to make sure it works before they commit to that. So what will happen initially is there's all these hardcore cruisers wanting to get back on ships, but maybe only 10% or 20% of the ships by June, maybe we'll only have 30% of all the ships running. You know, it might not be till late next year that we get back to, like, most ships being back at sea.
My thanks to Gene. Next up, if the flight attendant tells you to fasten your seatbelt and you refuse, you violate a federal law. Does that apply to mask wearing on planes? Chris Woodyard from USA Today has the latest. Joining me now, an old buddy of mine. We go back years on his days, and he's still there as a great reporter and correspondent for USA Today. Chris Woodyard, how are you, sir?
Very good. Thank you, Peter.
You know, you and I look at a lot of the same things. We monitor a lot of the same things, and we react a lot to the same things when it comes to travel. One of which being, and one of that is near and dear to our audience, is for the first time in recent memory, all the algorithms that the airlines use to project demand, who flew it on a November day a year ago, who's going to fly a year from now, and
what we should price it for this November, all those algorithms have gone out the window because of COVID-19, because there is no demand. There's nothing to gauge it against. And that means they can't, then can not only project, they can not only not project demand, they can't figure out pricing. And the result, which you've discovered and I've discovered, some very crazy airfares out there.
It's been amazing, Peter. You know, I went out on Google Flights and just sort of looked at various city pairs, looking at various dates, even some of the holiday dates. And there are some amazing bargains out there. I mean, it's almost on some of them. It was like if you were paying more than $200 round trip, that was too much on cross-country flights.
Exactly. We saw one from Los Angeles to Philadelphia for $45. We saw one from Los Angeles to Austin, Texas for $51. I saw one from New York to L.A. for $109. That's absurd. The cab ride from New York to Kennedy is $75.
I always loved that. I always thought that, you know, a great airfare is when it costs more to get to the airport on ground transportation than it does to actually pay for the fare. And we're seeing some of those kinds of cases right now.
We are. And the thing is, and of course the question that is inevitable is how long is this going to go on? Because if you take a look at how they projected bookings for the fourth quarter, meaning from now till the end of the year and into the first quarter of next year, they're almost non-existent. Traditionally and historically, every 4 years, no matter who's running for president and no matter who wins, it doesn't matter, Americans tend not to travel as much through their own sense of insecurity or uncertainty. They just don't. Every 4 years, it's like clockwork. So that's already in place. Then it was compounded by COVID-19. And then you see just nothing registering. I'm assuming, based on what I'm seeing, that with very, very few exceptions, these low airfares are going to continue through the first quarter.
I'm not sure, Peter. You know, you look at that federal stimulus deal that clicked off on October 1. You know, airlines, in order to get that federal money, needed to run a lot of unprofitable routes all around the country, serve airports that were really unprofitable for them. Without a federal stimulus in place, it's going to be really hard for them to continue that service. And as those flights drop, that will give them a little more leverage to raise fares. But we both know that the demand is so slack right now, so few people flying, that there's really good reasons to believe that a lot of these really great bargains are going to stay in place here for a while.
Yeah, they are. Plus, this year at Thanksgiving, not everybody's going back to visit Granny for all the obvious reasons. So it's not like going to be one big, you know, surge on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. We will see the TSA screen more people on that Wednesday before Thanksgiving than they're screening today. I get that. But that's not indicative of what the overall market's looking like.
Right. But remember, too, some of these city pairs are kind of off limits for travelers if they take quarantines into place. You know, some of the really great bargains are, as you pointed out, like L.A. to New York, San Francisco to New York. But there's a pretty strong quarantine order in place in New York that looks like it's going to be in place for a while. And that could really trip up travelers if they aren't paying attention to that.
Yeah, you're right about that, which leads me to my next item up for bids on the prices, right? The famous opportunity for what they're now calling air bubbles. Why don't you explain?
You know, this was something that the airline industry was really trying to get off the ground and was really trying to pin their hopes on. And the idea was maybe we can create really safe corridors around the country, really popular air routes that we can make 100% safe. So the idea is that everybody gets tested. You know, we now have some of these quick tests that are coming into place. Some of them are going to cost as little as $15, which means the airline can actually afford to eat that cost. So in the case of the United States, we were thinking of New York to London, an amazingly thick, popular, and super profitable air route, particularly for what few business travelers are left. If they could get every traveler on that route to be tested for COVID and come up negative, that could really help improve the confidence that travelers would have to travel again. Now, we're seeing that already on the Hawaii run. San Francisco to Hawaii, you know, a number of the state of Hawaii is allowing these quick tests in lieu of quarantine for folks that go there. So So there is a model for this idea, but the problem is that COVID rates have been rising so quickly around the world, U.S. and Europe, as the weather gets cold, that it's hard to imagine these bubbles really getting into place.
And now we have a situation in London where they, where you know, the airlines are trying to do an air bridge and a bubble from New York to London. At the same time, the United Kingdom is reporting that as many as 100,000 people a day are getting infected over there. They're not about to drop the ball. They're not about to open the door. At the same time, United Airlines is testing a program where they're offering free COVID testing to any passengers on the Newark to London route.
And that's an amazing situation, an amazing test case for them. JetBlue was going to be trying to pull off some of this same pre-testing idea down in the Caribbean, because so much of their traffic depends on the Caribbean. But as you point out, the politics of this are what really getting in the way. Unless these COVID rates drop, it's going to be really hard to pull off a air bridge that's really effective. You know, they've been trying it a little bit in the Far East as well, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, India, but it's, they're having the same problem. You're seeing some very high rates of COVID in some of those countries, or you might have it in one country and not the other, and so the politics of it become really, really problematic.
The only one that I've heard of that might be working is the bubble between Australia and New Zealand.
Yes, that's possible, and, you know, those are two countries. New Zealand in particular has gotten, you know, acclaim around the world for what a good job they've done in holding down their COVID rates. But if you're a New Zealander, you might not be so hot on the idea of Aussies coming in if you sense that they're not doing as good a job as you are.
And, you know, you mentioned Hawaii. Up until October 15th, they had a strict 14-day quarantine, no exceptions, and everything short of an ankle bracelet with you in the hotel. What they're doing now, Hawaii did reopen on October 15th, I think this is brilliant. They want you to stay in your hotel, and what they're doing while they're looking for secondary testing is anybody who checks into the hotel, they give them a plastic card key, of course, but it's a single-use card key. So if they try to sneak out of their room, they ain't getting back in. They'll know it's them.
Yeah, I love that idea of people stuck out in the hallway, unable to get back in their rooms if they try to break quarantine. The Hawaii thing's really interesting. You know, you get tested within 72 hours before you leave. But even the Hawaiian government knows that there's going to be a certain number of people that still test positive once they get there, just because of the nature of the testing, which gives rise to that secondary test that you talked about. So it shows that these air bridges and that kind of pre-testing idea are great ideas, but there's going to be a little bit of leakage. There's going to be a little, you know, number of cases that get through that still of people that are still testing positive, and that could be a problem.
I agree. And the real problem in Hawaii is that there's no consistency between the islands. The big island doesn't want to get involved in it. Maui is the only island that's requiring, mandating wearing masks. And then nobody really knows about the secondary tests, what requires it, and when they're going to do it. So right now, there's still a lot of confusion in Hawaii, and they're only getting right now about 4,000 visitors a day, when a year ago they were up to about 100,000 visitors a day. So it's something that they can manage, but the question is, can you manage it as a traveler, not really knowing where you can go and what you can do? We're talking to Chris Woodyard from the USA Today, from the USA Today. Reminds me when I used to work for Newsweek, people would always introduce me as Peter Greenberg from The Newsweek. So I'm just returning the favor. Sorry
well,
about that,
Stephen,
Chris.
Stephen Colbert back in the day used to always talk about the USA Today. So it's kind of a badge of honor to be the USA Today.
Well, then I'm in good company. Hey, you know, it's interesting when you think about one particular issue that's happening at 30,000 feet these days, and that is people still politicizing masks, still refusing to wear them, and the airlines being put in a position of being sky cops, but without any legal authority to enforce the rule, because there is no rule. The U.S. Department of Transportation has refused to make a rule requiring masks worn on airplanes. Now, of course, this is the same agency that does make a rule that you have to wear a seatbelt. And if the flight attendant asks you to wear the seatbelt and fasten it and you don't, you're not only in violation of an order from the flight attendant, you're in violation of federal law. You not only get thrown off the plane, you get arrested. That's not the case with masks. All the airlines have at their disposal is the opportunity to ban you from future flights. And that's what airlines like Delta, American, and United have done. I think Delta's banned over 700 people so far from future Delta flights for refusing to wear a mask. That's crazy enough for the adults in the room, or the adults, I should say, acting like children. But here's your segue, Chris. What about kids in masks?
Kids in masks are a big problem, Peter. You've got very young children that are required to wear masks, age 2 and up, on just about every carrier. Now, trying to keep a mask on a 2-year-old, trying to get a 2-year-old to do anything, much less wear a mask, can be a real problem. So you may have seen, we've had a number of incidents, very highly publicized, oft-times videotaped, of single moms, or at least moms traveling alone with their child, getting kicked off of planes because they can't keep the mask on their 2-year-old. Oft-times they'll get on the plane, the kid won't settle down, the plane is out taxiing, the captain brings the plane right back to the gate. So this has become a big problem for parents, and with the holidays coming, it's going to be a bigger problem.
I know, and the question is, with no enforcement ability other than a company policy, the flight attendants are angry because they're being put in an awkward position of having to be sky cops without any kind of legal backup. So what's the solution?
The solution is you've got to be sort of a smart parent here. You need, if you have a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or even a 4-year-old that you're fearful isn't going to be good about wearing their mask, at least when the flight attendant's present, you need to make sure that you drill them ahead of time, kind of practice with them, say when we go to the airport, here's what you have to do. Let them pick out their own mask. If they want a Spider-Man mask or a Superman mask or whatever, get them to pick out the mask they'll wear. And one traveler who had been thrown off a plane said that she thinks one trick might really work well for parents. That is, have their drink cup or have their food cup handy. So, remember, there's a rule on most of these planes that if you're eating or drinking for a short period, you can have your mask up. So this person who got thrown off the plane says that she's been back on a number of flights and everything's gone okay, but she says if there's an issue with her child and the mask, she has a drink cup or food cup so she can say to the flight attendant, he's eating and drinking.
Do I have to bring my food cup and drinking cup too?
Yeah, well, as we know, that there have been a number of adults that are getting thrown off of planes, as you pointed out, the no-fly list. In some of those cases, they say, I'm eating and drinking. And they say, well, you can't be eating and drinking for 45 minutes or, sipping your coffee at a few drops at a time. So that's where some of these cases have arisen over eating and drinking issues.
And there's one more thing about masks. And the airlines now have put together some of their own rules about what you can wear that would be, basically interpreted as an acceptable mask. You can't show up looking like Darth Vader. You can't show up with like 5 different kinds of masks with expiration valves.
Yes, expiration valves are out, even if you tape them over. I have one of those really great N95 masks, that I use for woodworking, and I taped over the little exhaust valve on the front. But now I even feel guilty about wearing that around town. And when it comes to airlines, some of them have no gaiter policies. So those elastic pull-up gaiters that go around your neck that you can pull up, which are very handy, by the way, but they don't do a good enough job. And so a number of those are not allowed on planes.
I'm going to tell you what I do now on planes. I wear the N95 mask, but I wear another N95 mask over it. I wear 2.
And, that's fantastic. And, also, Peter, a practice I know that you go for, get that valve over your head for the, air pointing down at your face and going full blast.
Full blast. My thanks to Chris. Well, it's a new year, a new administration. And what could a Joe Biden presidency do for the airlines, hotels, cruise lines,
and travel in general. Will there be more or less regulation, immigration rules, and travel bans? Scott McCartney, travel editor for The Wall Street Journal, has an educated guess or two. Our next guest, a regular on our show, not just on this show, but on our PBS series, The Travel Detective. He's the travel editor for The Wall Street Journal, the Honorable Scott McCartney. How are you, sir?
Hello, Peter.
See, you like I give you that title, don't you?
I love being the Honorable. I'm not sure. You're the only one who calls me that, which is a little frightening.
Well, we'll start a trend.
Yeah.
Everybody's sitting around now as we're waiting for the transition between the Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration. And there's a lot of speculation about what Biden is going to do in the new year and in the other 3 years to follow, especially in terms of world politics, global negotiations, not to mention travel and tourism, because if you want to talk about an industry that's been hit the hardest by the pandemic, it's travel and tourism.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think transportation in general is going to be a key cornerstone of the new administration. We all know that President-elect Biden loves trains, and so there'll be a focus on Amtrak and probably high-speed rail as well. But roads, electric cars, a whole bunch of issues, and a huge plate of aviation issues waiting for him. Consumer issues, things that haven't been dealt with, from, you know, finalizing rules on emotional support animals, the refunds that people didn't get during the pandemic, to the potential need to have another bailout of the airline industry and related transportation companies. And I think, too, the need for international protocols of how we're going to travel in the future, what's going to be required for quarantine, vaccination, testing, all that. The United States could lead on that and really set, you know, ground rules that would be adopted around the world that would make travel a whole lot easier for people.
Well, you know, let's go back to Amtrak Joe for a second. He's not called Amtrak Joe for nothing. He was taking that train from Wilmington to D.C. just about every day and going back every night. He's always been a fan of the trains. But back in the Biden administration, let's not forget, they tried to do high-speed rail, and all the governors, well, not all of them, but most of the governors either said, let's wait, or some of them just opted out.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Amtrak needs a boatload of money. There are a lot of needs. They've got to build a new tunnel into Manhattan. Amtrak is going to suck up a whole lot of money, but high-speed rail is interesting. There's a project under construction in California. It's kind of the stupidest, craziest thing you've ever heard. It's the train from Bakersfield to Merced, in the Central Valley. It would be hoped that it would be a link in a train from San Francisco to Los Angeles. But that's a huge stretch and a lot of opposition to it, and so that's difficult. There's a private effort in Texas that's moving forward. There are some signs that, you know, there could be high-speed rail in the United States. It won't be nearly as extensive as what you see in Europe or Japan. But I think there is the potential to start, and you have a train enthusiast who may see these projects as, key for things like climate change. If we could start moving towards high-speed rail and eliminate get a lot of cars off the road, get trucks off the road, reduce the short-haul airplane flying, then it might be good for the environment.
You know, it's interesting because it's all about the tracks, isn't it? I mean, one of the reasons why we don't have high-speed rail is because Amtrak doesn't control the tracks. It's controlled by the freight lines, and they don't care about high speed. That's why Amtrak trains have a problem maintaining an on-time performance schedule, because they always have to pull over to the side of the tracks to let some lumbering 100-car freight train go by. We got to figure out that before we even get to the technology, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's right. Certainly for the long-haul trains, that's been an issue. You know, freight lines would like their trains to move faster too. So there may be some mutual investment here that could happen to really speed things up. The tracks in the Northeast Corridor A lot of it is controlled by Amtrak, and it just hasn't kept up with there's not the congressional funding that's kept up with the infrastructure. So it's in terrible shape, and that needs fixing. There are a whole lot of issues with tracks. With some of the high-speed rail things, it's not just the huge expense of building the track and laying all this out, but actually getting the land from landowners who don't want a high-speed rail coming through their farm, their backyard, whatever it might be.
Or it could be mayors who will say, you can have a high-speed train as long as it stops in my town.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, it's a local. Let's go a little bit beyond that. I remember in the first two or three weeks of the Trump administration, we heard the words Infrastructure Week. I haven't heard those words in nearly 4 years. Is this an opportunity now to create jobs if Biden actually focuses on it?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think this is something that you can get bipartisan support for. Now, infrastructure for the Biden administration, I think there'll be a lot of focus on roads, bridges, tunnels, things like that, but also creating a network of electric charging stations for electric-powered trucks and cars. We've talked about the rail. I think there are still some big airport projects left to do, and so you may see spending on that. I think you'll see a lot of infrastructure attention turned to mass transit systems. A lot of the people who are advising the incoming administration on transportation have experience in subways, Metrolink, bus systems as well. So I think the notion that expand and support mass transit and that can get more cars off the road and do something for the environment, I think that will get a lot of attention.
And by the way, the two people considered most likely to get the slot as the Secretary of Transportation is Mayor Garcetti in Los Angeles and former Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Chicago.
Yeah, and both have a lot of mass transit experience. And that's, Mayor Garcetti, taking on building train service in car-crazy Los Angeles. He also has been involved in a massive rebuilding at Los Angeles International Airport, so he's got some experience with airports as well. But I think even at the lower level among the advisors, you see people with experience with the New York subway system, the Washington subway system, and Chicago mass transit as well.
And when Rahm Emanuel was President Obama's chief of staff, he was the number one supporter of high-speed rail.
Yes. Yeah. High-speed rail, it's going to be a tough sell. There is a lot of opposition to it. The other problem is you could go crazy on high-speed rail and you still probably wouldn't have trains rolling before the end of a four-year term. You could create a lot of jobs spending money building bridges, overpasses, track, everything you need to go into that, but you're not going to see you're not going to be able to ride trains in the next 4 years. And so that may be a bit of a deterrent, certainly has been in the past, although if you take a longer view and you say, what's the future of transportation in this country 20 years from now, high-speed rail may well be part of that.
Scott, when we talk about the global issues of travel, we go back to the first days of the Trump administration, the Muslim ban. Then later on, as the pandemic started to rage, the ban on other countries and nationalities coming to the United States, this immigration in general, which obviously involves travel, where do you see the Biden administration going in that direction?
Yeah, I should say, I think the first thing they'll probably do is impose a federal mask rule on airplanes. So we'll all have to wear our mask according to federal rules. But after that, a lot of people have talked about reversing the Muslim ban. That's probably one thing that will be done that'll get attention. I think the meat of the issue here is going to be COVID recovery. and how we treat international visitors in the future, both coming into the country and leaving the country, what kind of agreements are made with other countries to how U.S. citizens are treated when they go abroad. The hope, I think, certainly in the aviation industry and I think for travelers, is that there's some uniform protocol that's in place so that, your vaccination record is part of your passenger record, just like your trusted traveler number or whatever, and it goes into all your reservations, certainly your international reservations, just like your passport. And travel becomes a whole lot simpler because we know what the rules are. Right now, it's every country's got their own rules, and they may be quite different. It's not so much an issue right now because there's just no demand for international travel, but that's going to change. And I think there is a leadership opportunity here for the United States to say this is what makes sense. You certainly want to. Guard against the spread of a virus, but you also need to make it possible for people to do business and people to go on vacation and do things. And there's going to have to be a set of rules that makes that happen.
Speaking of rules, you can't not wear your seatbelt on the plane because it violates a U.S. Department of Transportation rule. You're violating a federal law. We're still waiting for the Department of Transportation to make a rule about wearing masks. They haven't done it. And that's what I think you're talking about, Scott, but that's just on an airplane. What about a federal rule of wearing masks if you're driving your car between Alabama and Georgia?
Well, it's interesting to me. You could make a federal rule. The president can issue a federal rule, but airplanes are one of the really one of the few places where the federal government has that kind of jurisdiction. The federal government's not out there on the interstate highway enforcing a mask rule when you drive from Georgia to Alabama, but the federal government does control interstate air travel, and so that is one place where it could make a difference. Now, you also you can impose mask rules for federal office buildings and facilities and things like that, but air travel, that's where they can really make a difference.
So we'll change the rule from interstate flight to avoid prosecution to interstate flight to avoid wearing a mask. How about that?
Yeah. Well, then it becomes the old Southwest question. Well, does that apply? Do you have to wear a mask if you're flying from Dallas to Houston so you never leave the state, so it's not interstate travel? And I think the lawyers would say the answer to that is yes, that now all air travel is regulated by the federal government. And so the state of Texas doesn't have jurisdiction over airlines. The federal government does.
And the thing that strikes me as somewhat ironic is here you have Delta Airlines announcing they banned more than 500 people from their flights, a no-fly list because they refused to wear a mask. The one thing they haven't told you is how long does that ban last? Is it just till the party's over, or is it a lifetime ban?
And most of them have said it's till the party's over. It's until the pandemic is over and you're not required to wear a mask anymore. That hasn't proven for a lot of people. That's not a huge penalty. Some people are only taking one particular flight and they don't want to wear a mask, or they don't really care if they fly Delta again. They'll go fly somebody else. It's the mask enforcement has been difficult for airlines, and compliance has been spotty. In some situations, most everybody does it, but it only takes one to sort of ruin the flight.
Not to mention, you are allowed to take your mask off to drink or to eat. But the question is, how long does your meal last?
No, that's true, and it's a real problem for flight attendants, and I think they very much would like to see a federal rule where you can say, hey, if you don't do what we say then on the mask, then this is the fine you're going to get, or this is the or you're going to get on a no-fly list for all airlines, not just one.
My thanks to Scott.
to Chris Woodyard and to Gene Sloan. And my thanks to you for listening to this Eye on Travel podcast. For more conversations with the leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for updates on all the breaking travel news, that's easy. Just sign on to petergreenberg.com. If you like Eye on Travel with Peter Greenberg, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings early and ad-free starting May 1st with a 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts.